Welcome to In the Elements.
I'm Dakota Smith.
And I'm Becky DePodwin. Welcome to our second episode dedicated to discussing mental health in meteorology.
If you haven't listened to the first episode, go ahead and do that now and come back to finish the series here.
For this episode, we wanted to dig in and highlight some of the strategies and mechanisms that exist to prevent and cope with mental illness.
We'll be joined by Thomas Jenkins, a meteorologist in the Department of Forestry in Oregon, to discuss his suggestions on how to cope with long shift hours.
And we'll also talk with Rebecca Moulton, a meteorologist with FEMA, who will share her experiences and how they've impacted her mental and emotional health.
Before that, Becky, I wanted to talk about our last episode. We released it 5 days ago, and wow, the response was incredible. Along with the episode, you wrote up a blog post that went in depth about your experience with major depressive disorder, titled "She Looks So Happy, How Can She Be Depressed?" Awesome title, by the way. What has the response been like, and what kind of conversation did it start?
So the response has been incredible, even beyond what I thought and what I hoped. I really just hoped that I got maybe 5 or 6 people, 10 people being like, hey, that's, you know, I kind of feel the same thing. Not that I wanted people to feel the same thing, but I wanted to know that I was connecting to people. And the response far exceeded that. I had probably at least 15 to 20 people send me direct messages.
Wow.
A lot of those people sharing their story, saying that my story really helped them realize that there was more going on that they needed to address, that they needed to talk to somebody, but they were so glad to see a professional and someone they considered a role model talking about it. And that, to me, like, blew my mind, you know? I think also a little bit coming on the heels of AMS, where I was able to really further establish myself as a professional, and especially with students, I think seeing me in that professional setting and then seeing me being so open about my experiences really struck people. So I've had zero negative comments. I've had no one say anything like what I talked about where, you know, you're so weak, you're depressed. Like, that's why would you talk about that? I've had none of that, which was a little bit surprising. I thought I'd have at least a few negative comments. But like people like Jim Cantore telling me like, this is great that you're doing this, you know, and it was really powerful and eye-opening to see like the more we talk about our stories, the more other people will be able to as well. And they'll hopefully get the help that they need. Like, I got the help that I needed several years ago. So it's continuing the conversation that people like Ginger Z started, and that's all I could have hoped for.
You know, I was blown away by the response to your post and then to our episode. When someone said or quoted the episode and said, I was so glad to find I'm not alone, or now I'm going to take an action to maybe see a therapist or something, I was just like, oh my God, that's amazing. I didn't think it was going to do anything like that. I, you know, was hoping people would talk about it, but I didn't really think about the direct impact it could have. And that is priceless.
Yeah, especially with the shift work and operational forecasters. I think we all knew there was kind of this unspoken bond between people working shift work, but this really brought it into the open, and people were very honest about the struggles that they have and sharing the tips and stuff that they do to help cope, and some of the stories were really crazy.
Yeah. I think it struck me most when someone said, like, now I'm going to do something, now I'm going to call somebody, because for me, that was one of the hardest parts. I remember exactly where I was when I called the university counseling center, and it was a big moment for me. You know, the person on the other line was just doing their job, but I was like a wreck on the other line. I wasn't like crying or anything, but I was just emotionally, I was just like a wreck, because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm doing this, like, you know, you kind of think something's wrong with you and you're just like, why does it have to come to this? But for our episode to encourage people to take that step, I have no words to describe, you know, how that makes me feel. So we had such great feedback and so many people wanting to share their stories. We actually had to make a second episode.
Yeah. And I think that's incredible. And I think that speaks volumes. People, despite the stigma, people want to talk about mental health. They want to be given permission to talk about it by society. And the only way that's going to happen is if we start talking about it, you know? And so I think it's so great that all of these people have been coming forward and sharing with us their experiences and being open and real about what it's like to suffer from, you know, depression or anxiety or anything like that. So a huge shout out, because you guys are so courageous and brave.
So before we get to our interviews with Thomas and Rebecca, I wanted to, for one moment, talk about kind of our starting points and where, when we started to get better, when we started to get help. We touched on it in our last episode, but I wanted to shine a light on that aspect of it all, because that's, you know, one of the key moments. So for me, I kind of alluded to this. I was in my car outside my apartment and I called the counseling center and set up an appointment with a therapist. And I did a few of those. And after I did a few of those sessions, I started talking about what I was going through out loud with friends. And that made the difference. I was living with my best friend at the time. And every time we would hang out or whatever, or even if I was just like making dinner and he was playing a video game or something, I would just talk about it. And that was the turning moment for me when I could open up about it. And, you know, he would also talk to me about different things that I like didn't know were going on. And that was the moment. That's when I, you know, started to feel better and get better. Becky, I don't know if you have a story about that first moment.
So the moment that I really decided that I needed to see somebody that could help me beyond what I could handle myself was almost 4 years ago now. It was the summer of 2014. I had just moved to Pennsylvania. I knew a few people here, but I didn't have close friends. I had my boyfriend of like 9 months at that time.
Husband now.
Yeah, he's my husband now. but we were pretty early on in our relationship. I had just moved, so we had just started living in the same city. I didn't have anybody besides him that I could talk to. Unfortunately, my family isn't really someone I talk to. But I felt really alone. But I also knew that at that time, if I were to burden Dan, my now husband, with all of these things, that I didn't know if our relationship would survive. You know, it's a lot for one person to handle, much less two. And I knew that I wanted to be the best version of myself that I could be. But I remember we were sitting on the steps outside of the place where I was living. I was living in a townhome and we'd gone for a walk and it was nighttime. We were sitting on the steps and I was like, I need to see somebody. I need to do this. I need to get to a point where I'm okay. And weirdly enough, this was before shift work. This was before I had started the really crazy shift work here. And I'll be forever grateful that I was already in therapy when that started happening, because that was really kind of rock bottom for me, was when I was in the middle of shift work in the middle of therapy.
Yeah, that struck a chord with me. I don't know, maybe you painted a picture that I could relate with and picture, you know, well. But it's weird, though, like we have these similar stories, but they're so different, right? Like we're going through similar feelings and struggles, but the things that cause them, and it's so different, but so similar at the same time.
Yeah. I had someone make that comment to me, like there's so much you can relate to in someone else's story, even though it's vastly different than yours.
Right.
It's bizarre, but it's, like you said, it's really powerful. And now we're joined by Tom Jenkins, and I'm going to let him kind of give his story background. We'd love to hear about your schooling, your current role, how you got there, and kind of any events that may have shaped you and gotten you to where you are. Give us the scoop.
Good to meet you both online, Becky and Dakota. So I have almost 14 years in the Weather Enterprise for experience, the majority of it with the U.S. military Weather Enterprise. Originally with the Air Force, now with the Navy Reserve. And recently, the last 3 years, I've been affiliated with a state agency, the Department of Forestry here in Oregon, doing air quality forecasting with the use of prescribed or controlled burning as a land management tool here in the Pacific Northwest. Education-wise, most of my education has been through the Department of Defense education activities, although I do have a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Studies from the University of Washington up in Seattle.
That's quite the gambit there.
And the sleep situation really hasn't changed very much in between the employers.
So what kind of shifts do you do now?
So now with the state, we have two working meteorologists, and we each pull four 10-hour shifts in our office. Typically, we cover 5 days of service during some of the slower months of the year, so Monday to Friday, like most civil servants. But when we get into our spring and our fall prescribed burning seasons, we do expand that to 6-day-a-week operation.
Oof. And that's usually by yourself.
Yep, by myself.
How and when did you become interested in and an advocate for mental health?
Well, my original weather career with the military, I was in the Air Force Weather Enterprise for nearly 8 years. And the entire time we were on rotating shifts. So very frequent schedule changes. And typically the shifts were about 8 hours. But when you have a constantly rotating cycle, it doesn't take long for the effects of poor quality of sleep or just lack of consistent sleep start to creep up. And, you know, it's one of those shared things. So it doesn't impact some folks more than others when you're working in this career field. It's something we all easily relate to. After my second deployment to the Middle East in 2010, I came back with a little bit of stress just from the circumstances themselves, but the primary symptom that the stress had was affecting my ability to kind of calm at the end of a work day and get into that nice restful frame of mind that you need for quality sleep. And then again, since I was still in the rotating shift lifestyle, not getting good sleep just kind of turned into a compounding problem. And so that's when I first reached out for assistance through our mental health provisions on base and just made sure that I was doing everything I could to try to get back into a good frame of mind.
First off, it's great that you had that resource really readily available. What did they recommend that you do to make sure that you were doing everything that you could?
A big part of it was just little things in the environment for my home. So recommending that I do my best with light management, especially having to try to sleep during the day when most other people would typically be out and about and active. And then the big thing was just controlling the presence of electronic screens right before the sleep period is supposed to begin, just making sure that, you know, I'm slowly calming down in terms of the activities that I engage with, and then just trying to make it more conducive environment for sleep by having it as dim as possible when I'm ready to go to bed.
So my husband has read about the no electronics in the bedroom before bed and constantly harps on me. And I, as of yet, have refused to give up my phone before bed. Have you found that it really helps you wind down and sleep better?
You know, I have. The strange thing, I got to take a 12-month kind of break from my civil service job here when I got recalled to active duty. And for the majority of the time, I was working and living in an environment where I had little to no personal electronics. The schedules, the shifts may have been a little bit longer. I worked a standard 12-hour shift most days, but I had some of the best quality sleep I've ever had because I just simply had no electronics present when it was time for me to clock out for the day.
So what other coping mechanisms do you use and recommend for mental health? The ones you mentioned were all about sleep, which is obviously vital to mental health. Is there anything else you do that you would recommend to others?
A big part of it is physical activity, you know, during the periods of the day when you're up and awake. I find that just being more physically active just helps me naturally go through most of the energy that I have for the day. And especially if I get opportunities to go out to the gym or do other, you know, more vigorous physical activities, especially in the evening hours, you know, if I feel like I've still got a lot of energy to burn off, that physically helps tire me out, and that mentally just makes it a little bit easier for me to wind down and get ready to close the day.
So what advice do you have specifically for shift workers, and what about for those in emergency management who deal with disasters and trauma on a regular basis?
Don't be afraid to be a self-advocate. I mean, for most of these opportunities, we're there on a voluntary basis if we're not working professionally within the field. And, you know, you want to be the best volunteer. You want to be the best team member possible. And sometimes that means, you know, outlining a very clear boundary for, you know, your work balance. The biggest thing that I noticed through different types of rotating shifts and different lengths of shifts, kind of the least of all evils that I encountered was very early in my weather career, where we only rotated our shift every 30 days. And so you had, you know, several weeks to get onto a set schedule, and then we rotated forward. So if you were working the day shift and you would typically clock out around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, you would have a few days off, and then you would move into the swing shift when you would come in after the lunch hour and then be there until sometime shortly after sunset. And I think those two elements went a long way towards mitigating a lot of the issues that we have with sleep and the stress associated with lack of sleep.
Is there a specific stigma surrounding mental health in the science community specifically that you would like to see get broken down?
Absolutely. I think more and more these days, people, and, you know, no matter what your discipline is, and in some cases, whether you're, you know, an applied practitioner or working in more of a research, an academic setting, there's kind of a lot of motivation to try to be, you know, the most productive member of your organization. And in a lot of cases, when you're an early career professional, to try to really make a name for yourself. And, you know, looking at the example set by other senior people that you work with, and maybe even some educators that you've had going through your different education journey, hearing some of the stories about, you know, all-nighters that they pulled or long research projects that they may have been involved with in emergency management, you know, some of the extended deployments away from your home area, that kind of gets normalized and unfortunately institutionalized over the years. And I think that that's something we really need to push back against.
So now we're joined by Rebecca Moulton. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to In the Elements.
Hi.
How and when did you become interested in mental health as well as an advocate for mental health?
I think it happened gradually over a series of several events. One of my best friends, who I've known now since I was an undergraduate, she is a social worker, a counselor. She used to run a domestic violence shelter, and now she's a professor of counseling. And so, you know, she's always sort of looked out for us in various ways. And early on, after I graduated undergrad, she was the one who sent me my first yoga mat right after school. And so I've been practicing yoga now for about 17 years. So yoga has always been something for me that is, it is my mental health life raft. Without it, I would be completely lost. And I know everyone has different coping and support networks and everything. So yoga is not for everyone, but for me, it really has been incredibly beneficial. And then more recently, I've been pretty public with sharing. I recently went through a divorce myself, and having two young children, that's been very stressful. But I also recently was diagnosed with some autoimmune issues. And that to me just really pinpointed the importance of the sort of the link between stress and the body and self-care and the importance of really taking care of ourselves.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot to go through. Thank you for sharing that.
I ended up having to face those diagnoses myself this year, along with, you know, all of hurricane season and parenting and all of that. So it's definitely been a journey, and yoga has really been critical to me even still.
So yoga is a coping mechanism you use and recommend. Are there any others that you have utilized throughout the years or that you would recommend to people?
Yeah, I think it's really important to establish a strong support network if you intend to have any career in meteorology whatsoever or emergency management, because having people that you work with, they understand the situation, they understand the weather and the stressors, but they may not necessarily know you personally. And those in my closest circle, to be honest, they have no idea what I do, but they kind of do. And but they know it's important to me, and they know it's my passion, and they know it's really important. So, you know, during Irma, I was getting a lot of messages from my friends and family. Hey, are you okay? What do you need? What can we do? And that type of support, just knowing, I actually got a message from my yoga teacher who said, hey, just wanted to let you know, I think you guys are doing really important, incredible work. And I just wanted to tell you, I was thinking about you. So things like that. It's important to have a life outside of meteorology. I know we all love it and can be incredibly passionate and the weather is amazing, but have something that you're excited about learning about and can dive into, whether it's painting or guitar or underwater basket weaving, you know. It's important not just for, I think, stress and wellness and mental health, but it's important just as a person.
Yes, I absolutely agree with everything you've said. I think it's really important. I think social media has helped with this, but to show that you're a person, you're not just, you know, a weather robot that spouts out forecasting information, but that you have a life, that you do enjoy things outside. And I think it's not only for your own personal mental health, but also for the sake of like relating and connecting to the people that you're trying to reach. It's really important to show that you are a balanced person, I guess. You mentioned a little bit like the stigma of the introverted meteorologist and how that's kind of getting broken down. Is there any other specific stigmas surrounding mental health in the science community that you would like to see getting broken down?
Oh, geez, that's a big question. I think there's definitely a lot of stigma. And I think one thing you hit on was the social media age has really changed conversations. And it's given people a platform where maybe they feel safer to bring up certain issues, whereas also maybe some people don't feel quite as connected. So it can kind of go both directions. But I think it's really great how the next generation of leaders like you and Dakota are bringing up a topic like this, because you know, my generation and maybe those before me, there is this pervasive attitude, and I've been told this several times in my career, and I'm a pretty tough cookie, and I've been told several times, you know, you just need to toughen up. So there is kind of this expectation working really long hours, going, you know, full out, nonstop, meeting the mission requirements. People, you know, the stigma is you don't take time off. You don't get sick. You don't complain about, you know, having, I don't hear anyone else around me saying, I can't come in and work this hurricane because I need to take my kid to their first day of kindergarten. There's just, you know, not a lot of patience for that type of thing. So, you know, they'll actually call you off your vacation. I've seen worse examples too. But I think as people are realizing how important it is to cultivate the wellness of your employees and be there for them and help them take care of themselves, you just can't really hand them a pamphlet and say, take care of yourself. Well, what does that mean? And by the way, you don't give me any time off to do it, right? So as an example, when I was down for Hurricane Irma at the Hurricane Center, we did not do this, not to throw them under the bus. We were not healthy. But back in Atlanta, the RCC, they had a little exercise wellness group. So the night shift crew, they all got a group of people together every night at 2 a.m. and they would walk around the building a couple laps and do some desk exercises and stretches and try to bring in healthy food for each other, because it's not like you can go run to lunch and grab a salad. There's not a lot of options at that time of night.
So speaking of shift work and stuff like dealing with disasters and the trauma that, you know, emergency managers and meteorologists face, what advice do you have specifically? You mentioned a little bit, you know, like the bringing in healthy food and stuff like that. Do you have any advice to cope to get through those really, really tough time periods?
Yeah, I'm probably a more extreme example, because optimally, unless you're choosing a job in, I'm trying to think, at a state EMA in FEMA Region 4 or with FEMA, you're not going to be exposed continuously to major level disasters 24/7, 365. Hopefully there would be fewer and far between, but still impactful to you. I think it's important ahead of time, like I said, to recognize if you get in this field, there will be a point where you're going to see something really major. And I think meteorologists think that they can, quote unquote, handle it, because a lot of us grow up either as tornado junkies or, you know, hurricane hunters. That's what we want to do. And we don't realize the effect it might have on us when we see the stories that happen after some of these events. I remember early in my career at FEMA, our regional administrator at the time was a very straight-faced, stoic, older man. He didn't make a lot of emotions, but he addressed us the morning after the Boy Scout Jamboree tornado, and he was moved to tears from that, and he was the federal coordinating officer for Andrew. So that says a lot. So there will be an event that, as meteorologists, you're going to feel more likely than not overwhelmed. It's, you know, everyone reacts differently, but it catches you off guard. That happened with me with Katrina. I had been working at the Weather Channel. We leveraged their cable equipment to send the highly specific evacuation information to communities and information about sheltering and where to go and et cetera. And I had stayed up the entire night of landfall, prior to landfall, sending as many messages as I could until I was pretty certain that either people had to shelter in place or were out of power. And that was including, you know, seeing the message come out about take your axe to the roof and all of that. And I remember, because we're a media company, we had TVs at our desk. And so I was exposed to the aftermath a lot. And it got to a point where I said, guys, I've got to turn this off. And it was even a month and a half later where someone close to me said, hey, you know, you really haven't been yourself lately. And I didn't even recognize what had happened. And so if you aren't familiar with some of the clues that you maybe aren't okay, it's a good idea to familiarize yourself with that. And for me, that particular time was, I was exceptionally irritable. And I realized part of it was because I hadn't been sleeping well. And since Katrina, I just had a hard time sleeping. And so one thing led to another, and I realized that, you know, this event had really overwhelmed me. So since then, I kind of have like a routine. My body goes into disaster mode, and I have some go-to things that I know work for me. My problem now is I still can't turn it off. So like, I still have a problem sleeping after an event. I still get in that disaster mode. I joke that they've implanted a chip in my brain for every advisory. So at 5 a.m. and 11 p.m., no matter where I am, like, I wake up. But I have to literally go on a full media blackout and not consume any information after a big event until I feel like I'm ready to do it.
I think that's really good advice. And I know there were a lot of people after the series of hurricanes that needed to take a significant step back. For me, after Harvey and with my sister in Houston and just poring over coverage and making sure she was okay, I really had to take a step back. So I definitely relate to that a lot.
Yeah, I think that's important. It's funny because I read something today that talked about the importance of not isolating yourself from whatever is kind of causing you the stress. So it might not be the most recommended method. That's not to say that I'm, you know, cold or callous and don't care. It's actually the opposite. I will go and read the stories, and I'm 100% affected by it. I just know how much time I need to step away from it in order to regroup myself. And I also know that I'm not in life safety. I might love meteorology and do important things, but I'm not on the front lines saving lives as a first responder. The best way that I can save a life is going to be by being at my optimal so I can focus on the mission and then get that information that's needed out to all the teams in the field. That's how I can help. And I can't really do that if I'm, you know, so overwhelmed by what I'm seeing in the media, or if I get caught up in negative press of the day or these headlines, and they're often very different from what we're actually working on or experiencing. I'm not saying they're not all, you know, true or false, but it's just very different when you're sort of inside, either at the hurricane center or working in FEMA. It's a very different experience than if you are experiencing it through the media. So yeah, I think it's important to be able to focus on that mission and keep some distance and let the people who are trained to help in that situation do their jobs. And, you know, that's not my forte. So that's helped a little bit. But I think it's really interesting to be able to talk to each other about this. Irma was the first time that I saw my peers actually talking to each other about, you know, are you okay? And it was a little bit of a difficult situation even for us when we work so closely together. You would think it would come easily, but we're not a touchy-feely group. And for them, you know, I flew in, so I was a visitor. Even though I was going to experience the effects of the storm, there was a high, I hoped, likelihood that I would be able to get out and go back to my home and have power and all the creature comforts, whereas they were really, you know, worried about their families and their homes and what was going to be waiting for us when we walked out the doors of the hurricane center. So there were some tense moments, and, you know, that was the first time that I really saw people say, hey, you know, let us know if you feel something's not right, or if you start to feel some physical effects like headaches and stomach aches or not sleeping, you know, check in with your body and see what's going on. And the leadership of the Hurricane Center sent very supportive messages to the staff and allowed them time to prepare and support their families, which I think is important too. So yeah, I think that's promising, I guess, that we're seeing more people talk about it.
If you have the slightest inkling that you can relate to anyone in these episodes, please, please get help. Reaching out to someone can only help you and put you in a better place.
In the description of the podcast episode, you'll find several resources that may be of help.
We'd like to thank Rebecca and Thomas for coming on the show and everyone else that shared their stories in our first episode.
You guys have no idea how powerful it is to hear you talking about your stories. So thank you for being so courageous and brave. If you like what you heard today, consider giving us a rating or review wherever you're listening. That really helps us and hopefully helps share the message that we're trying to send, that it's okay to talk about mental health. And, you know, we also talk about the weather too.
If you'd like to hear more of these episodes, they're in the feed you're listening to now, or you can find them over at theweatherjunkies.com.
Finally, we're always looking for stories to tell. So if you have a story that you want to tell, whether you're in your element, at work, or in the natural elements, send us an email at intheelementspod@gmail.com or shoot us a tweet at elementspod on Twitter.
Tune in to our next episode that dives into another important topic dealing with verbal harassment as a meteorologist.
That wraps up this week's episode, part 2 of Mental Health and Meteorology. For myself and Dakota, thank you for joining us in the elements.
Yes, science!